From Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. On Story features discussions with screenwriters and filmmakers who use the language of film and television to tell a story. On today's episode, we hear from Hustle and Flow filmmaker and legend of Tarzan screenwriter, Craig Brewer.
And John Singleton calls me up. And he goes, Purple Rain just came out on DVD and there's a commentary track. And I was like, John, we got a problem going into the third act. Got to edit it. We got a screening coming up and I don't know what to do. And he's like, I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to go get Purple Rain.
And later in our program, Boys in the Hood filmmaker John Singleton.
And the irony is that Tyrese was never the original person. That was supposed to be Tupac. And the last time we actually talked, I was like, got the movie that's going to get you an Oscar.
On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Memphis filmmaker Craig Brewer is the writer-director behind the films The Poor and Hungry, Hustle and Flow, and Black Snake Moan. His filmography includes the MTV series $5 Cover, the 2011 reboot of Footloose, and several stints in the director's chair for TV on the series The Shield, Terriers, and Empire. Craig Brewer is credited with the screenplay to this summer's The Legend of Tarzan, which opens July 1st. Austin Film Festival Senior Program Director Liz Mims spoke with Craig Brewer at a special screening of his first film, The Poor and Hungry, on April 26th, 2016.
Can you discuss whatever was most important to you that stuck in your mind and made you want to make The Poor and Hungry?
My father and I had this very close relationship. The movie's dedicated to him. As a matter of fact, I gave Ludacris in Hustle and Flow one of his lines, Memphis is best in your rearview mirror. And that's something that my dad would always say, even though I think he was kind of drawn to go back home. And so when I wrote Poor and Hungry, I sent it to him. And it was just one of the best calls of my life. He was so good. He was like, this is it. This is great. And I'm so worried you're going to mess it up. And I was like, well, why do you think I'm going to mess it up? And he said, because I think you're going to try to overproduce it. And you need to make this in such a way where it is in the spirit of the movie that you're trying to tell. You should shoot it yourself. You should learn the best you can about photography, and you need to edit it. And I remember my dad, he went to some sort of expo in San Francisco where he saw one of the first models of computer editing. And he was fascinated by this. He was like, you know, it's like word processing, but with images, you know, you can click on an image and move it around on a timeline. And I was like, well, I don't know how to do that. And he was like, well, this is the project that you should learn, but you should have complete creative control. You shouldn't listen to anybody else. And you should do it this way. And so I got very inspired and I went to Barnes & Noble and I bought up all the books I could on digital filmmaking. And I got home and there was a call to call my dad's work. And then this guy answered the phone and he said, Craig, I'm so sorry to tell you this, but your father started complaining of chest pains, and we rushed him to the hospital and he died. And he died of a heart attack. And my mother, I got to really hand it to her. She said, I think you should really try to make that movie that your dad read, because I haven't seen your dad so excited in a long time. So I just felt like I was, you know, I was making it for dad. And my dad, I think because he was always talking about what he wanted to do when he retired and the fact that he died at work, I think it just made me really try to make this movie as if it was going to be the last thing I made.
Throughout The Poor and the Hungry, what were the choices there with music, and were you specifically inspired by something?
I grew up in the theater and musical theater. My father, on Sundays, he would play music when we would clean up. Sundays in my house, you go to church, and then you either go to Burger King or Wendy's afterwards. It was always, that was always a big deal, like to go to a fast food joint after church. And then it was like you came back to reality because you had to clean up the house. And that was back in the days when, you know, you had vinyl, so everybody had their own record. I don't know if y'all remember this, but you could stack records on, you know, it would fall down in the carousel. And so, like, my sister would get one, and then my dad would get one, which was usually... like, you know, Fleetwood Mac's Rumors or Blood, Sweat, and Tears or something like that. My mom would get a Willie Nelson in there. And then I had like the Empire Strikes Back soundtrack. But my dad really loved classical music. And so he'd be like, oh, I noticed that you really like this, you know, this John Williams score. Have you heard Hulse, The Planets? Have you heard Beethoven's Ninth? Have you? And so classical music became something that was very important to me. And so then when my dad took me to see Amadeus, that was the movie that blew me away. I mean, I love blues, and Memphis has this. I knew a lot of musicians in Memphis, so I knew I could have that in there. But I wanted to like drop this beautiful music in the middle of this world and see the characters respond to it and see them actually fall in love with it for the first time. And it being by way of this girl. It's still my favorite image in the movie. He's listening to the headphones and he's in the strip club. There's this dancer, and these are all, none of them were actresses. Like, these were all real strippers. And I would be very, very honest with what I was doing in the scene. I would say, like, look, I want you to do a lap dance for this guy facing away from him. But what I want to see on your face is just, you're not facing the John. You're not facing the trick. So, like, you just need to be honest. This is day shift on a Wednesday. You know what I mean? Like, you know, this is not really the best thing that you could be doing. And so I'm pushing in on her face. And I remember hearing the classical music that I knew I was going to be putting over in my headphones as I was zooming into her face. And that juxtaposition of the music and her face, for me, it's like, I haven't topped that yet, really. Yeah. Like that, because it happened. I saw it happening. I didn't know it would be as good as it was that moment. And for me, that it meant a lot to me to see that moment.
So many filmmakers want to start with something like this project and move into something bigger, and you successfully did that with Hustle and Flow. Can you talk just a little bit about how you built attention from Poor and Hungry, and you were lucky enough to kind of build into something amazing?
Poor and Hungry became a kind of a local phenomenon in Memphis, Tennessee. And it won the Hollywood Film Festival. And so back home in Memphis, the local theater chain decided to do a run of the movie, and it ran for 8 weeks. It was one of the most popular movies in Memphis because it was very Memphis. Memphis was very much a character in it. So I was ready to let go. And then I would hang out with my friends who were rappers, and I'd go over to the house. And I thought they were big time, like, you know, Al Capone, 3-6 Mafia, and they were making beats like in their kitchens. You know, they'd be turning off the refrigerator so they didn't get a hum on the mic. And I had just been through this whole process where the four of us, like every time you go to Eli's house, that's our house. And my wife got pregnant and she was helping, you know, she's cooking meals and trying to keep us all going. And so if you look at me, my sister-in-law, you know, my pregnant wife, and then my brother-in-law, who was kind of like the techie guy, that's Terrence Howard, Taryn Manning, Taraji Henson, and Anthony Anderson. And I was just like, well, let's just set it in this world of rap. I'll tell the story of me making Poor and Hungry, but in a different setting. And I'm going to just shoot it this time in color on my same cameras. But now there's this D8, and I keep hearing that there's these digital cameras coming out, and maybe I'll do it on one of those cameras. And so I wrote Hustle very quickly. And then when Poor and Hungry started making the rounds in Hollywood as just a VHS screener, Hustle and Flow, the script, started going out with it. And this really great producer, Stephanie Elaine, got the script and read the script. And we tried to get it going. And then she gave it to John Singleton because she not only gave Robert Rodriguez a start when she worked at Columbia, but she gave John Singleton a start. And she was at Columbia when they did Boys. Yeah. And John read the script. He loved it. But then he saw the movie and he's like, oh, well, we'll just have you do it. You know, you'll direct it because look what you did with 20 grand. And like, you know, we'll just give you a little more money. Maybe you can make Hustle and Flow.
So moving into Hustle and Flow for you was a process. Were you surprised by how different the process was by having money? Or did you feel like you're still able to keep it kind of the way you wanted to make it?
That was the hardest lesson. Okay. And I'm so glad I had John Singleton. I call him my big brother because he really helped me. Because there is a big difference in shooting your own film where it's in your own hands and you're on your own clock versus you've got a crew. You've only got so many hours in the day. I'll never forget this one. Oh, yeah. It's the scene where DJ Qualls, who plays Shelby, the skinny white producer, arrives for the first time. You see the three of them. You see Anthony Anderson, you see Terrence Howard, and you see DJ Qualls. And it's the first time they're talking about music before they start performing Whoop That Trick, the first rap song in Hustle and Flow. And John comes up to me and he just slaps me on the back and he looks at me and he goes, "You got some ideas on how you're gonna shoot this?" And I was like, "Yeah, yeah." And he goes, "Okay, let me just throw one idea at you. You need to do this in three setups." And I was like, "Okay, well, we'll put the camera in three different places and then we'll swing a lens." He's like, No. "When you swing a lens, you put on a different lens. That's another setup. So I'm telling you, you got to do this in three setups." I was like, "Well, that's not really what I wanted to do. I wanted to do this thing where I came in with like a dolly." And he's like, No. We got lunch. Like, you got time for three setups. You got to figure out a way to do this in three setups." And then like he started walking away and he came back and he's like, "What, you don't think I gotta deal with this too with like big budget movies? Don't think that you can just come in. You've got a whole crew and you've got to know exactly what you're going to do, but you got to come in here and do it in three setups." And the first thing that I came to understand is storyboards and that planning, just forget about it. I don't know who's telling directors to do that. Like, I understand for like a action sequence where you're like, okay, half the crew's going to be over here with second unit. And okay, you're putting the little red X's like, okay, we did that sequence. But like when you're showing up to do a scene where people are talking, you don't do that because you don't know what your actors are going to do. And that's the thing that really startled me. And it was also the thing that electrified me. So I would only have one setup of like Terrence Howard walking in with a baby. And all he was supposed to do was just kind of take this baby and sit down and start playing a tune on the piano. So I go up to like Terrence and I'm like, "Okay, you'll do this, you'll do this, you'll do this." And he's like, "Oh, I am, huh?" And I'd be like, "Well, yeah, I'm the director. I'm supposed to tell you what to do." And he's like, "Well, why don't you just see what we do? And then you figure out what you're going to do." So it's like, all right, fine. Like, just walk in and do whatever the hell you want. So it's like, action. And then he walks in and this baby starts crying. And he's like sitting down. He's like, "All right, now, cut it, cut that out. Cut that out, cut that. And he turns to the baby who's looking at him. He's like, "Cut them tears out, man. Cut that, man. You can't be crying around like no bitch, you understand me? I didn't write any of this." And he's like, "Cut that out. Cut that. All right, calm down now." And he takes this baby and he starts playing. And it's like there was so much more humanity because it was from his gut and it was his first instinct. And there wasn't a like me saying like, "Well, no, you should turn this way into the light and sit down and do this." And that was the biggest lesson was, no, you see what the magic is and then you figure out your three setups. You know, if you got more time, you can do more setups. But if you can't figure it out, then you shouldn't be calling yourself a director. You got to shoot from the hip. And that is very different than when you're growing up and you're looking at the Raiders of the Lost Ark script and it's got storyboards in it and you're like, "I got to know everything. I got to know every angle on this. I got to come so prepared." And that's just not filmmaking.
Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, screenwriting software with over 100 templates that format and paginate screenplays, teleplays, and stage plays. More information at finaldraft.com. Austin Film Festival's On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with filmmaker Craig Brewer, speaking with Liz Mims at a special screening of Brewer's first feature, The Poor and Hungry, on April 26th, 2016.
I wanted to go back a little bit to your music choices, because you were saying you were so inspired by Amadeus.
Right.
Can we talk a little bit about that in terms of like musical plot points? Because there are moments in the film where it's like in Hustle and Flow that we know where something's changed. How much of that was writing the script and thinking about the music, and how much of it was editing for you and incorporating it later, or how did that work for you?
The first thing, okay, so Amadeus, I would go into these studio exec offices and they had read Hustle and Flow. First, there was this shift in seeing me, because I think first time I met Russell Simmons, man, he was like, you wrote this, you know, and because I'm not black, but there was this idea and they immediately thought that I was. And so when I came in, I was like, look, you need to understand something about Memphis. You need to say, and even on a bigger level to people in LA, you need to understand something about the South. I'm not saying that we don't have our problems. I'm not saying that we don't have systemic poverty issues and racism issues, but we're a little bit more integrated than a lot of people on the coast like to think we are. We're a little bit more in the mix, especially when you get below a certain economic line. So they shift. They're like, okay, well, we'll listen to you. And you obviously have a point of view on all this. And I was like, okay, Hustle and Flow reminds me of Amadeus. And they were like, whoa, no. You can't be talking about a movie about Mozart and Salieri and compare it to this pimp movie. And I was like, yeah, but I wasn't a huge classical fan when I saw Amadeus. The Requiem Mass scene. Do you all know what I'm talking about? Mozart, he's dying in his bed, and Salieri, who's been plotting to destroy him, is at the foot of his bed, and Mozart is line by line dictating, I believe, the third movement of the Requiem Mass. And you hear the music. Like, Salieri can't understand it. It's like, you're going too fast. I don't know what you're saying. And Mozart's like, it goes with the harmony. And just like the bassoons and basset horns would kick in. Bwam, bwam, bwam. He's like, yes, yes, bwam, yes, go on. He's like, no, now for the real fire. Violins, arpeggios from the top. And you started hearing just that line. And then he took it all and he's like, okay, let's hear it from the top. And you heard it all together. Blew my mind. Blew my mind when I saw that. I knew that if you saw these cats making rap and they were passionate about it, and you saw the effort that went into it line by line, people who didn't like rap would love it. Because they got to experience the creation for the first time. And I think that so many times when we see movies about music, we just see the music part of it. And we don't see the passion of creating that moment. And so I remember when they called me and they said that we've been nominated for an Academy Award. Hard Out Here for a Pimp has been nominated for an Academy Award. And I was like, we won it. And they're like, Craig, be thankful you got the nomination. This is ridiculous. We've made this song called Hard Out Here for a Pimp, and it's been nominated. It's not going to win it. And I was like, no, it's going to win it, because all those people who saw it saw the people in the movie loving it. And when you see it being created, then the audience is creating it with you. Second story. I'm going to try not to get emotional. I'll be 44 this year. Purple Rain was one of those movies for my generation that was an amazing moment. And I challenge anybody, I can teach a course on the first 8 minutes of Purple Rain. If you watch the first 8 minutes, you can learn a lot about filmmaking and storytelling. Purple Rain single-handedly saved Hustle and Flow. We were in the edit and we'd finished it. And there was just something that wasn't working going into the third act. I'll never forget, I was driving home and I pulled over on Olympic and I cried. I mean, I'm not talking about like, I'm talking like the heaving, like, you know, just really, it was terrible. I just thought like, I've ruined this movie. I've ruined it. And John Singleton calls me up And he goes, you got to get to Virgin. Virgin was this video store. And he's like, Purple Rain just came out on DVD, a new version of Purple Rain. And there's a commentary track. You got to watch it, man. And I was like, John, we got a problem. You know, we got a problem like the third act. You know, we got a problem going into the third act. I don't know what to do. And he's like, man, just I don't want you thinking about that. I was like, John, we got to edit it. We got a screening coming up and I don't know what to do. And he's like, I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to go get Purple Rain. You know? So I'm watching When Doves Cry. And if you remember, like, Prince, he's, like, running around. He's in his awesome black outfit and heels. And he's sad because, he struck Apollonia and she's left him. And he's going to the dock, you know, the pier. And he's kind of squatting there and he's kind of sad. But you're seeing footage from when he was with Apollonia earlier. I'm like, oh, when did he have sex in the barn? Like, when did that happen? Remember that one shot? And I was like, when did that happen? And I was like, oh, wait, here's another moment from that same costume. Oh, they must have cut that scene early. And then it's like, he's like, you know, maybe I'm just like my father. He's never satisfied. And you're seeing a moment that you saw earlier with his father beating up on his mom and Prince comes in and the father hits him. And I was like, well, wait a minute. I need to go back and re-edit this song, because what I could do is I could take scenes that I've had to cut out earlier and I could reboot what the stakes are in the third act. So I remember coming into Billy the next day, my editor, and saying, like, first of all, we're going to watch Purple Rain. We watch Purple Rain. We're going to do the same thing in our movie. So let's have Terrence rap the first verse. But the second verse, keep the instrumental going, take his audio out, and we're just going to have the instrumental going. And then we're going to cut to scenes that we've seen in the movie. Isaac Hayes going, you know Skinny Black? Yeah, I know Skinny Black. And then we cut to a scene, and I was like, oh, we'll put it here. Even though we haven't seen it, we're going to flash back to a moment that we had to cut from a moment that people will already remember. And it just reminded everybody, it's like, oh, yeah, we've been working hard to make this song, but now the third act's about getting it to this guy. And then just stay on Terrence's face. Don't cut to Taraji. Don't cut to anybody else. Just like in Purple Rain, meaning like when he's singing Purple Rain, you just hang on Prince for the longest time. And it's like, let's just stay on Terrence, because now he's like, we just heard what his goal is in the third act. And now this second verse has so much more power in it. And I remember we had a screening that night and people were just like, oh, my God, what did you do? Like, I now we're going into the third act and we know what we're doing now. In Hustle and Flow, I make references to Purple Rain. It's a very important movie to me. It's opera. It's a great movie. Don't laugh at me when I say that. It's a great movie. And it means a lot to me. I really got to hand it to John, too, because we would be at his office in Lemire Park in L.A. And he just knew all these incredible actors and actresses. Great people came through the door. I'll never forget watching. I still got on tape when Taraji and Terrence are doing their scene together. It's so funny to me because I've now directed an episode of Empire last season. And I'm going to do an episode this time. And so when I see those two, I can't help it. I just remember that day with Terrence and Taraji. But I'll never forget this moment where I went to my producer, Stephanie, and I was like, I have this real worry about Terrence Howard. And she's like, you do? And I was like, yeah, I mean, look, he's great, but I have this real worry and I don't know what to do about it. She's like, you're the director and you need to go in there and you need to tell your actor what you're thinking about. And so I went in and I was like, Terrence, I'm real nervous about talking to you about this, but I've seen you in all your movies. I mean, I've seen you in all your movies. The Best Man, this really incredible movie they did with Jeffrey Wright called Boycott, which is about the Montgomery bus boycott, where he played Abernathy and Jeffrey Wright played Dr. King. And I was like, you know, Terrence, you have this particular type of way where you have been a supporting actor in all these movies and you draw attention to yourself in this really great way, because everybody else is like, they're leads, so they have to carry the movie and they're acting with big broad strokes, where Terrence would just kind of like walk in there with his little dagger and just go, oh yeah, He had a way of like being understated where you would just like go, oh, he's interesting. And I was like, but you're the lead now. You can't do that on every scene. There's some scenes where you gotta be bigger and figure out when are those moments. And it was the first time that Terrence and I bonded. He was like, man, you're watching out for me, because if you hadn't said that to me, it'd be different. So some scenes he's really big. You know, there's that scene where he's coming out of the strip club and, you know, yelling at the junkie who's got the keyboard and trying to get some weed for it and everything like that. But then there's the scene where he's like coming out of the pawn shop where he's told Nola to, get the microphone, you know, and he's very Terrence in that whole monologue about, I know what you're doing. You're looking at her and you think that maybe she doesn't belong to me. Like, he's doing that whole understated thing that he was really good at. And I was like, well, we need to know what those moments are, because you can't do it throughout the whole thing, because we're going to edit. You're going to feel good on the day, and then we're going to get into the edit room and it's all going to be low. So what are going to be the peaks and valleys? Because you're the lead now. You know, you can't be doing like that supporting actor thing anymore. I mean, I love the actors in Porn Hungry. They had never acted before, and I think they did a phenomenal job. But having this caliber of actor now, where the best thing you could do is inspire them and then get out of their way, was amazing.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 5 school by USA Today, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. John Singleton made his filmmaking debut in 1991 as the writer-director of the groundbreaking urban drama Boys in the Hood. The film earned him Academy Award nominations for Best Original Screenplay and Best Director, the latter of which made him the youngest person as well as the first African-American to enjoy that distinction. Singleton's other films include Poetic Justice, starring Janet Jackson and Tupac Shakur, Four Brothers with Mark Wahlberg, Tyrese Gibson, and Andre Benjamin, and Rosewood, starring John Voight, Ving Rhames, and Don Cheadle. As we heard earlier in the program, Singleton also produced our other guest, Craig Brewer's Hustle and Flow. John Singleton's latest project, Snowfall, for FX Networks, is currently filming in Los Angeles, California. Screenwriter Fred Stripe spoke with John Singleton at the 22nd Austin Film Festival in 2015.
So I'm assuming everyone knows who John is, obviously. I know you've told your story a million times, because I've read it in a lot of different interviews and everything, but you are a storyteller. And for those, I think actually how you got started, you're at USC, you've got a few friends, but you're feeling maybe somewhat alienated. That story, I think, has resonance right now. So if you could just give us the thumbnail of what that was all like.
My story started way before USC. My story started when I was grew up in Inglewood, in an area called the Bottoms, which was all these apartment buildings that have now mostly been torn away. And a block over, there was a place called the Century Drive-In. So I grew up on the backside of a drive-in. I used to watch movies with no sound on them, and they weren't like The Godfather. They weren't great movies. They were like blaxploitation movies, Superfly and Pam Grier, Foxy Brown, Bruce Lee movies and slasher movies like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Halloween and stuff, like right outside of my window every night.
So you could literally see it outside your window.
Every night, so I would watch the films and without the sound. That and kind of reading a lot of comic books helped formulate my visual acumen. This is a time in the early 70s, late 70s, early 80s, where like there was a kind of a new renaissance in filmmaking and stuff, but not for somebody like me from my background. You know, I didn't have access to a Super 8 camera or anything. I didn't know anything about that. So I used to try to draw animated films in notepads. I'd make little adventures with my comic book heroes and Daredevil and Iron Fist and Luke Cage and stuff. And then I started getting smart. I got my homeboys who do know how to draw to draw every panel, and we'd make these little movies. We call them flip books. And I wished I had this thing. My friend, a real skinny, fair-skinned kid, and I still know him. And I remember in sixth grade, when we graduated from sixth grade, he wrote, you know how you have those graduation books where everybody writes something, everybody, he said to a great friend and good movie maker. But that's how I think I started with films and filmmaking. And then I'd start discovering, like, I think I saw a 2020 special on the making of Close Encounters with Steven Spielberg, and I saw Steven Spielberg directing, and I said, I want to do that. I want to do that, what that guy does. Mm-hmm. You know, but there was really no historical precedent for, like I said, a guy like me doing it. And but still, I was like, that's what I want to do, you know?
Well, so you get out of high school and you apply to USC?
Yeah, I mean, but even before I got out of high school, I was on a journey to go to USC. I was like, this is where I have to go to school. I read Dale Pollack's book, Skywalking, The Life and Times of George Lucas. Right. I think I read that when I was 15 years old, and it was talking about Lucas's journey, you know, from Modesto to USC and stuff. And I was like, that's what I got to do. I got to go there. My goal was try to go from college to the professional field the way that first-round draft pick would do it in NFL or the NBA. I want to get out of school and direct my first film.
There's 2,000 people in the program. I mean, they're all wanting that. So.
And that's what they told everybody. I said, I'm going to be that one that does it. That's what I said. I said, watch. And I did it. I mean, like, I had that attitude from 18 years old. I mean, like I said, I'm going to do it. I mean, 3 weeks before I started school, I saw She's Gotta Have It in Santa Monica, and I ran into Spike Lee. You know, it was his first movie, and I was going to meet him before I graduated high school in February or March of that thing, just before he went to the San Francisco Film Festival with that film. But my mother wouldn't let me use the car because she said, oh, this has nudity in it. I'm not going to condone that.
You find She'd a way never been up to your room to see what you're watching every night, right?
All right. And so I saw him before the movie started, and I said, hey, I've been, did a little name drop. And I said, hey, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing the movie. Yada, yada. He was cool with me. I go in the movie, see the movie, and I'm like, whoa, you know, I'm excited, you know. And I had seen the previews of the movie because I had just started going to what's known as revival theaters. They don't have very much of them anymore, where they show old films. The first time I ever went to a revival theater, I was bored, and I said, there's nothing to do. My mother said, go to that old theater, go see some movies. I said, fine. So I saw Woody Allen's Bananas and Annie Hall. Changed my life. Then they had this thing called the Midnight Movie. I went a couple weeks later with some friends of mine and saw A Clockwork Orange. And I was like, you know what I mean? So, you know, I started really going to the films I thought I should go see. You know what I mean? Because I was really in the commercial fair, you know, really. And so I went and saw Kurosawa's Ron. And then before Ron, there was a preview before She Gotta Have It. So I knew it was coming. But I didn't know Spike was going to be there. To make a long story short, I see the movie. I come out, and he's surrounded by all these Hollywood types, and they're all over him, trying to invite him up to Hills for a party. And he saw me there, and he said, excuse me. And he moved everybody out the way. And he said, what'd you think? And I just said, I'm on it. I said, at least some real black folks in a movie. This is good. I said, you know what else? I'm going to USC in 2 weeks. Watch out for me. I'm coming. And so we always share that story. When he speaks, he says that, and I'm like, yo, so my whole thing with going to film school was to just explore and try to find an identity and what I wanted to do as a filmmaker and just really learn and make something of the program. And the thing I've chiefly learned that most of the young filmmakers should be learning or concentrating on is it's all about having that original concept and genuine concept of where you're from. Your perspective and your POV, it may not be for everybody, but it's your perspective and it's valid. Even if it's just you, there's people out there that want to see what you have to say. It's like when you're making a film, it's like you're having a conversation with people. And if you do that very, very well, it will propagate in some way.
Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, screenwriting software with over 100 templates that format and paginate screenplays, teleplays, and stage plays. More information at finaldraft.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International will be back in a moment.
Thank you.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with filmmaker John Singleton speaking with Fred Stripe at the 22nd Austin Film Festival in 2015.
But so then some, I can't remember her name, but there was a woman.
Stephanie Elaine.
Right. And she became executive producer on some of your films down the road, didn't she? Or,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. She said, okay, let me see your scripts. And Boys in the Hood went to, was it Frank Price eventually?
Well, yeah, it was initially, it was Russell Simmons who read it.
Oh, right.
And then when Russell got excited about it, Stephanie had gotten informed about it. And so it's like, see, I told you this is this guy, you know, we got to find a way to get this movie made. But to her credit, she did what executives in this business would never do. She put everything online. She did everything but jump on the table. Like, this is a movie that we're here for. This is the kind of movie we should be making.
And I'd forgotten, so Russell was, he had a deal cooking with Columbia.
He was going to have a deal, and he cursed out the head of the studio, and, and so he didn't get the deal, and they gave me the deal.
Okay.
That's what happened. That's true.
That's how it works out.
Yeah.
But and then the next piece of that, too, was, okay, we've got this really cool script, so we're going to cut a deal, we're going to cut you a check, and you said, no, I'm going to direct.
No, they were testing me. They were saying, you know, hey, what if we tell you we want to buy your script and get somebody else to direct it? And I said, well, we have to end this meeting right now. And they're like, oh, you know. And I said, well, because I'm going to direct this movie. And, the whole idea was like, I got to act like, you know, nobody wants to give you nothing if you act like you really need it. So you got to be like, you know, part of that is a little hustle. It's like, okay, well, fine, bye. I wanted to do it my way.
Right.
I always feel like the cheapest way to make a movie is to write it. The hardest thing to do besides write a great screenplay, which is a hard mountain, it's like climbing Everest, is to write a great screenplay. The next mountain to climb is to get somebody to actually read your thing. And to get somebody to read your thing that can actually take the energy enough to make a phone call. You know what? This is something that we should try to consider.
Well, I know you've had a significant number of influences, and even today you're talking about more, but there's one influence, August Wilson. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. He did write one film, The Piano Lesson.
Yeah,
but
he was a friend of mine, too.
Yeah, that's awesome. So please tell us a little bit about that inspiration, because it's important.
Ironically, August is the reason that I became a writer. When I was a sophomore at USC, it was right after The Fences had just got all of its Tonys. When James Earl Jones won the Tony, it got Best Play. It won all the awards back east. So then they brought the production west, and James and Courtney B. Vance, who I just directed in recently now in the O.J. Trial, who's playing Johnny Cochran, they all performed, and my mother got me a ticket to it, and I saw it. That's when I really started writing, and I realized that I could have an impact. And one thing I learned from August's work, especially the early plays, was how poetically Negroid they were. There was a certain language that black people had that were unique to us. It was something that could be felt and intellectualized. You know, there's a line in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom where a character says, I may be a fool, but I ain't the same fool twice. That's when you and I part ways. And then when he would roll stuff out of a tongue. So I was like, wow. It was great in the literary tradition, but when you saw an actor do it, and an actor who had that rhythm and soul perform it, it came off differently. And then, so that's what I want. I want to be able to say stuff without saying it. Before I did Boys in the Hood, as I was in pre-production, I was taking acting classes right across from where the production office was. And I was acting as though I was just some guy that wanted to be an actor. I tell them all, hey, I work at UPS, and, you know,
this is your acting friends you're telling at the school.
The class.
Yeah, the class, yeah.
I really want to be an actor. I think I could do something really special and stuff. Mind you, I just come from the office where I'm like talking to the DP, talking to everybody, and we're casting Boys in the Hood, like one building over. And then this one guy comes, who was in my acting class one day, he comes to read for a part in Boys in the Hood, and he sees me in the office and says, oh, you working on this? I said, yeah, man, I kind of got a job over here. And he said, man, what you doing? I said, well, I'll talk to you about it later, man. I can't talk about it right now. They got me doing something, right?
I think you said you're working behind the camera.
Yeah, I'm working behind the camera. So then he comes up to read, and they said, this is Jackie Brown, the casting person. This is Steve Nicolaitis, the producer. And this is director John Singleton. He goes... and he really, that just threw him totally off. That threw his audition totally off.
So you were blown. There was no way you're going back to class. They didn't know you weren't directing.
I still went back to class, but they, and then I hired the woman that was my acting teacher. I hired her to be a coach for Cube and for Morris Chestnut and some of the people that, most of the people, that was their first movie. I would just tell my friends, hey, I want you to be in my movie. Even the casting director said, John, you can't put all your films in your movie. I said, I'm the director. I can do whatever the f*** I want to do.
Speaking about acting a little bit more, you've broken in more first-time actors. They may have had other careers, particularly in rap and hip-hop, but you've brought people to the screen, and not just done that, but done it. They've give these extraordinary performances. Mm-hmm. And so what's the secret? Is it alchemy between your screenwriting so they understand what you want and then how you communicate with them? Or
it's the material and it's the people and it's me and them in our relationship. Because just like I said with Jackie, I'm basically working with my friends. I'm working with people that I knew, that they feel comfortable. They just want to do for the project for me. Good examples as Baby Boy, only Tyrese and Taraji were supposed to have love scenes and have nudity clauses in it. But as we got into it, everybody wanted to take the clothes off.
Very relaxed.
Everybody's like, God, I feel free. I just want to, there's a funny story where they have this love scene and Tyrese is all nervous about getting in bed, showing his body and stuff. And Taraji is just like, everything is out. Everything. Just, and he's all shy. I don't know about this. And I'm like, you're going to sell more albums. Ain't nobody worried about this but you. And Taraji, if you know her, she says, get your in this bed. You're going to up my first love scene. I got worked up for this. Get your in this bed now.
And that's a relaxing.
And we're playing R. Kelly and stuff. And then Ving, it's like the scene that he does in the kitchen with the Kool-Aid and everything like this. After he does the scene, we're in the middle of the neighborhood, right? And he walks out in his robe in the front of the house, in the hood, and all the girls are like, ooh, da, 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 da. He drops his robe and walks butt naked in the whole damn neighborhood to his trailer. And all the women are like, oh my God, I can't, da, da, da. People are like, thank God they didn't have camera phones back then. It would have been Instagrammed everywhere. And the irony is that, Tyrese was never the original person. That was supposed to be Tupac. And the last time we actually talked, I was like, got the movie that's going to get you an Oscar. It was like, he was supposed to be Jody. As good as Tyrese is in the movie, and he's my friend and baby brother, every time I watch the movie, I'm like, if Pac would have played this part, I've been blazing.
Was the experience in the industry, did it mirror sort of what your experience would be in L.A., where you're kind of an outsider trying to get in, having to advocate for yourself?
Oh, very much so. But the irony of it is that once I made my movie and my spots with that movie, I was welcome in open arms within the business.
But then Spike's letter to you in Poetic Justice, it does say, be careful for that second or third film because...
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, they took after me on Poetic Justice, whatever, because I had so much accolades on the first movie. But I knew that was going to happen. The movie opened $13 million. I was like, it opened more than it cost, so I knew that I had to kind of mitigate whatever was going to come at me. And I always felt that even though, hey, it's a great movie, Boys is a great movie, it spoke to something that it was already in the zeitgeist but hadn't been seen cinematically. And over time, it's even more propagated and become even more important. It begot, even Straight Outta Compton now, this year. But I feel that a lot of the press that I got was in backlash to how certain people felt about Spike at the time. Because he was the only person out there saying, Hollywood is f***ed up. You don't hire enough black people. You don't get credit to enough black artists or any people of color. And let's take black people out of the equation. Before we were press testing the Oscars and all this stuff, you look at a movie like The Last Emperor, which is one of my favorite movies. Yeah. All these Oscar nominations and no acting nominations.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
John Lome, John Chen, Like none. And he got 10 or 12 Oscar nominations and none for the acting. So he was the only person out there kicking dust. And then I come along and I said, here,
No, I also felt that you had the sensibility of an independent filmmaker. You're going to make it.
Yeah.
But then you kicked in the front door and got in. And so I can see what you're talking about, this backlash. Well, okay, we got one in, so just forget about it.
Yeah, it's like more of a kind of a tokenism. Like, okay, we did something right. But it wasn't like, you know, like, okay, well, you got this guy and there's some other people in it. You know, I felt that what I was doing was kind of like what certain people at my peers at the time that I looked up to, like, you know, people like Gus Van Sant, you know what I mean? Like, when I was about to prep Boys in the Hood, I would watch Drugstore Cowboy over and over and over again, you know what I'm saying? Because I liked what Gus was doing. I never thought I was going to be a studio filmmaker. I always planned on being an independent filmmaker.
Right.
So then once I got a chance to do some studio films, and you have an ebb and a tide and weight of that where you're a studio filmmaker and whatever, it wasn't so much of a thing for me to say, you know what, when they say, well, we don't want to make this thing with you because it's too wild and crazy, that's okay, fine, I'll go do it on my own. And then I made Hustle and Flow.
Right.
I produced it. You know what I mean? There's so many great, great things that would have never come if someone had said, well, I don't know if I should tell this story because it's not going to identify, nobody's going to identify with it and everything, right? You know, you look at a great movie, Ben Zeichen did Beasts of the Southern Wild. The movie could never have been made in the system, but he just had a vision for what he wanted to do. Right. You know what I mean? And he did it. And he made it kind of homegrown. He shot it over a period of time, and it just, you know, it's a poem.
It is, yeah. What was it like to mentor people, and then they go off and do things, and do they come back? Or
it feels good. Not everybody has to come back. Just do your own thing. I mean, there's a kid that I met when he was 16 years old that I got him into USC, who's from the jungles right down the street from my house and my office. I got him in USC, and all he had to do was go for 1 year in junior college, and he couldn't do that. So then he did some other stuff and whatever this, and he went to acting conservatory for a second, got kicked out of acting conservatory. He wanted to be a director. He came up to me, he said, I'm going to be the next you. I said, no, you ain't going to be next me. This is what you got to do. He's now 23 years old, and he's been acting, he's been directing and all this stuff, and he's the second lead on my TV show right now.
Really?
So he's acting, but he's also with me, like, learning how to direct. After a certain while, you know, he is able to click in to exactly what I was trying to tell him all these years. Sometimes people come back and some people don't. That's just life. I mean, I think it's harder for me to tell my kids what to do. And I have two of them in film school, and everyone else wants to know my advice. My kids say, you know, okay. I don't know nothing. You know what I'm saying?
Like, that's being a father, right?
I know. I had no experience before I did Boys in the Hood. My process was to read the biography of a very interesting filmmaker, then watch their pictures. You know, I could take someone like Alfred Hitchcock and then watch his pictures. You know, I read a biography of Fritz Lang. You know what I mean? What made Fritz Lang so unique when he was making those movies in Germany? And then watch his German films and then watch his American films, right? That was before I got a chance to actually have the equipment. So then when I get the equipment, I'm like, okay, I'm just going and interpreting. And then as I started exploring this field and talking to other filmmakers like Francis Coppola and different people around, I was like, yo, if you're going to steal from the best, and you see like Martin Scorsese's work, who's a brilliant filmmaker, right? A lot of what Marty Scorsese did in his early work and some of his later work is all from great filmmakers. He pulls from Fellini, he pulls from other Italian filmmakers from the neorealist period and stuff, right? That shot that he does, the tracking shot that everybody loves, we have everybody in the foreground and background and everything like this, that's straight out of Fellini. But even Fellini, I feel Fellini was doing that in the tradition of the big Italian frescoes. So Fellini's doing something that is maybe 500 years old. And then Marty looks at it and he makes it his own. For me, it's like, it's recreating spontaneity. You know, whenever you put the camera on, it's not life, it's a reflection of life, but you have to recreate spontaneity. You've had to have seen Taxi Driver. But if you only seen Taxi Driver once, twice, three times, you haven't seen it enough. If you watch that movie is like, it's a mixture of stark reality and dream reality.
Yeah.
And that's why it works. That's what I'm always like trying to go after. Like, okay, yes, I can do something very, very hard, realistic and all that stuff, but can I do something that, you know, that can only be told in a cinematic way that will, after people see the experience, they want to see it again and again and again. not necessarily because it makes them feel good, mm-hmm. but because it brought something out them emotionally. It mm-hmm. brought something out to you emotionally that you're like, why am I feeling this way? Let me go back and watch it. You know what I mean? So that's what I feel I'm going for as an artist.
Well, I know you're going to be teaching at USC for the first time, I guess, this coming fall. Is that
a
right?
long time, yeah. The course that I'm teaching is called Emergence of Multiethnic Cinema. And it talks about how the breakdown in the last 100 years from a manifest destiny attitude of white male-dominated cinema to more of a multi-ethnic point of view of cinema now that is now the commercial idiom. And it starts with John Ford in 1962 with Sergeant Rutledge, where Woody Strobe, he was the black dude that got killed in Spartacus. And John Ford put the camera on him and made him a buffalo soldier. And he's like larger than life. Mm-hmm. So he shot Woody Strode the way that he shot John Wayne. Mm-hmm. The first time a black man had ever been shot like that. Wow. And you watch it and you're like, whoa. Mm-hmm. This is about 9 years before Shaft. So I showed that kind of movie. And I showed Blazing Saddles. Because Blazing Saddles was written by Mel Brooks and some of his former writers from Your Show of Shows. Yeah. And Richard Pryor was in the room. You watch that picture and you see how the relationship between Cleavon Little and Gene Wilder, and the stuff that they talk about innocuously is funny, but it breaks down so many different barriers. And it becomes a conversation thing, you know what I'm saying? Right. And so, like, I go through all this thing all the way up to 48 hours, and all that stuff with Nick Lotti and Eddie Murphy, where he goes on the thing and says, you know, hey, I don't like white people, so y'all know I'm enjoying this. And Nick Lotti said, you know, hey, I'm sorry about that spear chucker, you know, kind of business, you know. I mean, it's like humor, right. but also in a genre movie, you know what right. I mean? You get to, like, Pulp Fiction. You know, Quentin was the first modern filmmaker to actually make a multi-ethnic movie where everybody was cool. Mm-hmm. Usually it was just the white guy was cool and everybody of color was just like whack and they got killed. Mm-hmm. Right. Sam Jackson doesn't die in Pulp Fiction. It's about the breakdown of what I call the manifest destiny of cinema. All the way back to the silent age. If you didn't have Sidney Poitier in The Heat of the Night with Rob Starger, you wouldn't have Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte right. in 48 Hours. So there's a kind of a lineage showing that stuff. If you didn't have Gordon Parks directing Shaft, I dare to say you wouldn't have Denzel Washington. I have this show, and it's going to be a monster. It's called Snowfall. And we just finished shooting it last week. It's L.A., 1982. It's how cocaine changed L.A. There's some good stuff in it, man. And everybody is represented in a different way, but it's not didactic. You know, it's like really like cool. You know what I mean? It's representative. It's kind of like a culmination of everything that I've done is going right into this show. So it's got drama, humor, action, my friends in it. You know what I mean? My formative years were the 80s, and a lot of the movies that I really like were from the 80s. You know, some of them are throwaway pictures and stuff, but, you know, a lot of them are action and genre films and stuff like that. And the reason it's called Snowfall is because it's all about cocaine, but then you know that once the price of cocaine goes down, there's something called crack coming. And when it comes, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a storm. So it's like, everybody thinks it's a crack show. They're like, oh, he's doing The Wire. It's like, I don't copy nobody. People copy me. Like.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Clayburgh Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. Generous support is also provided by the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan, and the show is produced and edited by myself, Brian Ramos. I do the music for the show as well. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Katie Stewart, editing help from Jamal Knox. Production assistance from KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and conference in October. Until next time, I'm Brian Ramos, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.